One, two, three, come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin now with a spin, traveling in a world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation.
What a view, paradise. Simply look around and
view it.
Oh, anything you want to
do, what do you
want to change the world? There's nothing to it.
Hello there. Hello, ladies.
Hello, is that Rick?
Hi there. Rick? Welcome.
Hi there.
Yes.
Hello. Hi there.
Hello there, folks. This is Progressive News Network. We're starting a very wonderful seasonal set of shows, and this is our first opening night of the poetry sessions, and I have the wonderful and talented Miss Aria Ligi, and you can correct my pronunciation in a minute, and Dominic Windrum, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
So please, Aria, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, let's see. I was born and raised in
New York. Let me start you off, okay? When did you first start writing?
When I was 8.
When you were 8. Now, were you writing down stories? Were you doing little sketches? What was it that first, what story did you have to get down?
Well, the first things that I was writing were actually poetry. And also plays. I was actually reading by the time I was 2.
Wow, cool.
So writing was really, really pushed in my family as well as reading. I was fortunate enough to go to a very, kind of preppy but also very academically focused prep school. Which had its good things and bad things, but the good part was
that it
was really, really focused on reading and writing, and specifically reading classical works. So
all of that
was really inbred in me in a very young age.
Well, let me ask you this. What is the last thing you were reading? A poem, a story, a novel, the newspaper. What was the last thing you were reading today?
I mean, as of right today?
Before you called in.
I was reading over my own poetry.
Good.
And then last night I was, I'm currently writing a book of poetry for Shakespeare. So I'm in the middle of reading a biography of his by Peter Ackroyd, who's a really fabulous biographer. I've read several of his biographies. It's been kind of challenging to find actual real biographical personal information on Shakespeare. So I've read several books on him. This one so far seems to be the best one in terms of actually having more to say about him as a human being rather than just, little things about his plays, which then they say, because he wrote, so many things about birds, therefore he must have been really interested in birds. Well, it really doesn't tell me
one
much
of the
about
things...
who he was. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one of the things that I've always found amazing about Shakespeare, besides the marvelous insight that he has into human beings and his exquisite language, it always amazed me that there's so much controversy surrounding him. My wife and I, for example, we've had a theater company for 20 years. And one of the things that we do for fun is we host Shakespeare parties. And what we'll do is we'll pick a play. And we invite friends to bring a copy of the play. And we don't specify an edition or a version or whatever. Because there's always that ambiguity. And then we draw from a hat for parts so that pure chance does the casting. And mm-hmm. you know, we allow for people to trade because, you know, you don't do a part if it just, you know, freaks you out. And it's a lot of fun. But one day I was inviting some people who I thought were intelligent, literate people. And this chap turned on me with the most vehemence and said, well, everybody knows that Shakespeare didn't write that. And I said, you know, my friend, I don't care if Elmer Fudd is proven to have written it. The work is so powerful, it really doesn't matter.
Right.
And, you know, there's these theories about the Catholicism, and there's the theories that there's other noblemen who knew more and learned more and were more worldly. And, you know, I think that's absolutely beside the point. But, well, that's wonderful. That sounds very interesting. And let me pause for a moment there and bring Dominic in for a minute and ask him roughly the same thing. Dominic, when did you start writing, my friend?
I think I was about 16 years old when I started writing, a bit later than Aria, writing poetry specifically. And I've continued that.
What was the impetus?
The impetus? I was kind of actually influenced a lot by sort of song lyrics in popular music. And
sure.
then I started
sure.
reading. Yeah, I kind of like to bridge between the lyrics and kind of poetry. And I just thought I could do that. When I heard lyrics by musicians
uh-huh.
that I liked, I thought I could write better than that. I could do poetry, you know, turn it into poetry.
Well, let me ask you, were you a musician yourself at the time?
Just listening to music, just the lyrics, really. Not a musician.
Uh-huh.
I've never really, you know, followed that. It's mainly been the writing, yeah. And I've obviously
uh-huh.
read lots of poetry since.
Sure.
What you said there about Shakespeare is interesting because
uh-huh.
obviously I'm from England and there is this real class system here, with like a snob value with Shakespeare. Yeah. There's a lot of people that don't want to believe that he's kind of from the upper class system. Somebody like Shakespeare couldn't have wrote, you know, the plays. Yeah. So.
Sure.
It's like
well,
that
the thing
here
I
the
think. The thing. One of the things that I find, you know, sad in a way about Shakespeare in America anyway, is that
yeah.
it's widely regarded as literature with a capital
yeah.
L. It's regarded as highbrow, elitist, snobby sort of stuff, not for plain folks. And
yeah,
when
yeah.
anybody ever says that sort of nonsense in front of me, I try to remind them of something that a lot of people forget. It wasn't just – these plays were not presented just to royalty. The Groundlings
– yeah, absolutely.
were
yeah.
a lot
yeah.
closer to the action were probably, by and large, not literate at all. So there was
yeah.
a degree of slapstick and you know, bald body humor that of course, you know, when delivered in the lilting aristocratic high British – really doesn't come across, and
it's interesting
because,
when I studied it at school, it was put on a pedestal as though you know you can
right.
this is real highbrow, and it was only after I finished school I really got into Shakespeare. Actually, I didn't enjoy it at school at all. It was you know reading it myself afterwards. You know,
sure.
I didn't take it for my degree. I did philosophy, but I sort of read a lot of Shakespeare alongside that, and I found that. It made a lot more sense after school, basically. Yeah, yeah.
Sure. Well, I was asked to teach a literature class at a private school at one point in my life.
Yeah.
And when the headmaster said to me, well, Richard, you know, I have a lot of respect for you and for your learning. I think you're a very literate person, and I think you have a good way with children. If I was to ask you to teach a class in literature to the students, now we're talking about third grade through sixth grade, so what would
yeah.
you teach? What material would you draw upon? And I said, oh, well, there's no question. I would go to Shakespeare. And she
yeah,
looked at
yeah.
me and said, well, I guess you have the comic books or something. You have a children's version. I said, not at all. She said, oh,
yeah.
come on now. You don't expect children that age to understand it. And I said,
yeah.
well, I think if you give them the right material, you allow
yeah.
them to explore it, and you pick the right plays – I think they have a chance of understanding it very, very well. And she said, oh, I think
yeah.
that's ridiculous. And I said, well, tell you what. you sit in the class with me, and we'll read act after act and scene after scene. And if you think they really don't understand it, then I'll stop. I'll say, you're right. So
yeah.
She said, well, then fine. That sounds reasonable. What do you propose that we read? And I said, well, I think we're going to read King Lear first. And she, you would have thought that I suggested we read pornography. She said, are you kidding about that crazy old man? I said, no, wait a minute. I think if you look at it that way, you're really not understanding what's going on in that play. She said, what are you talking about? I said, well, for example, I said, how does that play start? It starts out with a family at the table, and the father foolishly wants to know who loves them more. I said, now what child hasn't wondered if they're the favored one or the one who's discarded? Every
child
absolutely,
thinks that.
And she said, well, I've never thought of it that way. And I said, then what happens next? Well, okay, dad gives it up wrongly to the wrong one because he's foolish. And then the kids get to divide dad's stuff. Now, what kid hasn't thought that they could do much better with mom and dad's
toys
than
idea.
Mom and dad?
Yeah, yeah.
And she said, you know, I've never looked at it that way. So she was so amazed. The kids took to it like ducks to water. And now, not everyone got every word. Not every phrase, of course, you know, was completely understood. But among the group, in the context, they perfectly understood it. In fact, they insisted on, we did two more.
Great, yeah.
Well, you know, we've threatened this audience, two fine poets. And I think the least we can do is go to poetry. So, Aria, let me ask you, my dear, if you would share one of your poems. And set it up.
Well, let me ask you this. I have 23 books, as Dominic knows.
Well, then you're probably at a loss for pieces.
So my question is, I will give you a thumbnail sketch as to what we could pick from. I have personal poetry.
Trust your judgment.
I have my 14-book series from the Romantics. I have a book that I wrote for the High Masters of the Renaissance, the painters. And a book that I recently wrote for Queen Caroline, who is very, very derided throughout history. And several poems for Princess Diana. So take your pick.
My dear, I trust your judgment implicitly. This is the opening poem of the poetry show. Use your good judgment, my dear.
I'll use my good judgment then. And you know what? I will go to one that is not published, but it is probably one of my favorites. And I have to pull it up here. And I actually mentioned this to Dominic because he knows that I love William Cowper, who is, even though it's spelled Cowper, it's Cooper. So you have to remember that he was a 17th century poet who was friends with William Blake. And unfortunately was kind of went mad. He had, I believe, probably bipolar disorder.
Sure.
Which is extremely common and extremely sad. And I've actually wanted to write a book for him, but I haven't been able to find enough material. Kind of like Mr. Shakespeare. So I'm trying to find it here. I wrote a poem for him. Here it is. And it's just, I just titled it Cowper or Cooper. So I see within the gleaming press his face, his like, his loveliness, and the spark and softening pain, the look of love, oh, wholly drained. Then ho, the sigh sunk in his breast and mired where the darkness slyly crept. I know the place, intimate and dear. It loves me as a brother and himself as no other. The howls and cries, oh, his magnificent globe. We shine and part o'er the sheen and unseen road.
Lovely. Absolutely lovely. Well, you know, you opened the door to the Romantics, and they're such a wonderful gift to civilization. Why don't you go ahead and do one more from that period, from your work on the Romantics?
Okay, then I will I will read you one from my book on Mary Shelley, who I totally love.
Another one of my favorites.
She's my girl. And by the way, if you want to talk about somebody who wasn't formally educated, but was a wonderful, wonderful writer, she is a woman. And
astounding.
This is called
writer.
Immoral Woman. Yes. This is called Immoral Woman. And it was kind of written for her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft.
Mm.
Oh, to be an immoral woman, wrapped in the coat of exile, fettered in etiquette, proclivities pinned to navel, the tightness of divinity, set as a whirling blanching, eyes smarting at my atheistic propensities. Oh, to be an immoral woman, it fell about me from the womb, as if to love those who have less is base, and to steal those who have not, call me immoral, not ever chaste. For I am a lover of man. My arms are an overflowing, unending ebbing about this mass of immorality. I am an immoral woman, hewn from my mother, this abundance, this treasure, this scurrilous, not scurrilous nor mundane, but opening, givening on this landscape profane.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And then I will give you one more because there was one that I wrote for Mr. Shelley. Yeah. And this one is short. It's very short because I believe in one thing above all else, which is economy.
Uh-huh.
So in other words, writing so that each word really truly means something, but not overdoing it.
Right.
This is called In Your Hands, and it was written for Percy Bysshe Shelley, in Mary's voice, and it's important to know this, Percy would actually go around giving blankets and soup out to people who are homeless, even when he had no money of his own. And you have to remember that he was disinherited from his father. So this is called In Your Hands. The purse so bare, we do not care. Our love is all, it feeds my mouth. In you there is great goodness. I find it in your hands which love me, in your hands which feed me, in your hands outstretched among the poor. Though our pockets can find only tuppence, others have only threads, mice-infested holes of the wretched, in your hands we have bread.
Very nice. Very nice.
So that's why I said I believe in economy.
Sure. Well, that's marvelous. That is absolutely marvelous. Dominic, good sir.
Yes.
I know you will grace us with some of your work. Again, reach into that wonderful bag of letters of yours, and why don't you share a few with us and set them up?
Well, yeah, I mean, I've always been influenced by Romanticism, like Aria, but I want to do a poem about the counterculture of the 1960s, because I think that that was influenced by the Romantic movement, definitely.
Sure.
Yeah, and it basically used personification, you know, to talk about a flower child from the generation, and to sum up the era, basically. And it's called a Lament for the Slow Death of the Counterculture. Oh, you were once wild and beautiful, when summer's rays reclined in your hair, and your being blazed in valleys and hills. Oh, you were once a force so vital and rare, when brief flashes and fragments of grace pierced the warm, feathered air, and the light of love lit up your face, when crude flesh and fiery spirit were wedded in deepest communal bliss, and your youth's blood morphed into roses in the sweet garden of promise that once seemed so fruitful and endless. Or you were once wild and beautiful, but now you're a ragged recluse, degraded by the needle chill, lost in a twilight world of absence, removed from a place you once infused with colour and art and consciousness. Now innocence has been badly wounded, and despair corrupts our sacredness. Yet I still cling tightly to the vast scope of your vision. In the spectral seas of prayer, in the righteous rage of hope, in plagued streets placated by prophecy, amidst the glitter, neon and concrete, amidst the ruins of modernity.
Lovely.
It was
I love your writing, Dominic.
Thank you.
And I think
I just wanted to say I really love his writing.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. It's lovely. Dominic, you want to share another one?
Yeah, this one is about kind of contemporary culture. The rise of the internet. It's called We're Floating in Cyberspace. We are floating in cyberspace. We are liberated from the weight of the past and its rigid tribal claims. We are floating in cyberspace. We are dazzled by advertising while surfing over chaos. We no longer need to decipher ancient symbols and signs. We are floating in cyberspace. Images chase each other like reflections on the water. Illusory worlds glimmering traces. We are floating in cyberspace, endless transmission of ideas across oceans, borders, and displaced without unity, though we yearn for its embrace. We are floating in cyberspace, free to dream forever, free to construct new identities as the omniscient eyes of surveillance chart our progress under the stars.
Very nice. Well, you know, you've both been so gracious sharing your work with our audience. I want to turn this around, and I'm going to share a poem or two of my own. And since you've spoken so beautifully of love and of those magical times, I'm going to read to you a couple of my poems of love. This one first. I am one of those fortunate people. I met my charming wife while I was still in high school, when I was 15, and we're still married 46 years later. And this is a little poem I wrote for her. Most of the poems I've written for her are for her ears only, but this is one that I've shared. It's called How I Love You. I care more about how I love you than about anything else I love. How you look in the morning, sleep, slow to rise from your eyes. How even when sleep hasn't been long and morning comes too early, you still bring a smile to your day. I care more about how I love you than how many days it has rained since I first was blessed with your caress. When I see your smile, I forget about sorrow. When I see your smile, I forget cloudy days. When I see your smile, I forget I had a day in the silly world. When I see your smile, my own clouds part. When I see your eyes, I know what mountain peaks know. When I see your eyes, I know what the waving ocean knows. When I see your eyes, I have seen the glance of eagles. When I see your eyes, I know the loving caress of God. Your smile across the table removes the vast distances of deep space. When I see your smile across the table, snow melts and streams can be forded. When I see your smile across the table, armistice has been achieved and peace talks can begin. When your lips connect with mine, the walkout is over. When your lips touch mine, the roses bloom across the garden. And tulip merchants cry foul, taking wing before such beauty, mocking their goods and all. When your smile's lips touch mine, happy children laugh. When your smile's lips touch mine, the wheat settles above the chaff. When your smile's gifting lip touches me, I am reborn in finer clay. When I see your smile, I see the day.
Oh, great stuff. Very vivid imagery there, yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Thank you. Thank you. Now, I'm going to ask you,
really
folks.
Nice.
Thank you. I write with a lot of humor. I'm a very socially conscious fellow, and I would say two out of every three of mine I like to teach with humor. I think it helps. So when I was involved in a peace organization, we got together we were a coalition of groups that were opposing the Iraq war. I forget whether it was one, two, or three. It really doesn't matter. We opposed them all. But the only time there was trouble in this coalition was over religious matters. Our Jewish brothers and sisters and our Arab brothers and sisters, or this faction and that faction, there was just a little friction. So I pulled together a meeting of just our Jewish friends and just our Arab friends, and we worked something out, and it came to a new forging of peace, and that was a wonderful thing, and I was so happy. And as we're walking away, a fellow comes up to me, and I was so pleased. I figured he was going to come over and thank me. He came over to me and said, "So obviously you're a Jew." Suddenly all that joy I felt just really kind of evaporated. So this was my response. It's called, "Are you a Jew?" "I'm a Jew, I'm a Buddhist, I'm a pagan, and what's truest, I'm a Christian and an animist, sometimes a philanalist, a Tibetan and a Hindu, and no matter what you do, I think I like what you do. God, I think she's very open-minded. I'm reminded when St. Joan's at stake, I'm calling Blake. When Luther calls, I'm an Eskimo too. At least that's the least I can do. I wear a ghost shirt to my baptism when Martin causes a schism. I'm a Muslim and a Druid. My position's rather fluid. I'm a Sikh and a Taoist, and that I think I'm proudest. A capitalist and a pinko. At least sometimes I think so. Sometimes I'm agnostic, a Rastafarian Coptic, a Methodist, contrarian, or even a Liberian, a sectarian Siberian who often turns to Mecca while counting on Kabbalah to get him to Shambhala. A Catholic Baptist evangelist, a Dunker agrarian fundamentalist, a seven-day adventurist, a Scientologist apologist, juggling snakes with the Lady of the Lakes, while playing aloud at Delphi, a Mithraic tantric yogi, a Jasmine playing boogie. A close insight to God, at least that's what we thought, a Confucian and a Shinto, it seems that's what I'm into, a Calvinist and a Navajo with a nodding wink to Xanadu, a Cherokee, a Schwabian, a Swinburgian, Zoroastrian Hussite, a Theosophist and a Thelemite, spilling celestial spiritual dynamite."
Great, yeah.
I love it.
So, I'm all of that. I get around. But enough of that. Let me turn to you, Aria, and let me ask you this.
Yes.
You know, many people in Western society think of poetry as that thing that academics and crazy people do. And whenever I'm confronted with that, I have a series of explanations that I give. And one of the main ones is, you know, if you're a sport person and you attend sports events, you hear them chanting their little rhymes. And I explain to this barbarian or savage who doesn't get poetry, I said, you know, if it wasn't effective, they wouldn't chant it at football games. So, Aria, let me ask you, when someone says to you, "Poetry," what's your response typically?
Well,
are you fortunate enough not to run into that type?
No, I've run into it. And in fact, somebody said to me recently, they said, "Well, you know, not everybody likes poetry." And I was like, "Okay, not everybody likes, you know, I don't know, squash. I mean,
tapioca.
You know, or tapioca. I mean, everybody has their taste, right? Not everybody, you know, understands the rules of chess. I don't care, you know? But as far as poetry goes, I mean, this is what I come back to, is I really come back to the work of Lee Hunt. And I mention Lee Hunt because he was the founder and editor of The Examiner, which was a prolific magazine and newspaper in the 18th century. And he was also a champion for the people. And because he spoke truth to power, he was jailed for 2 years in King's Bench Prison. And, you know, if they weren't so threatened, then why would they care? So to me, poetry has significance. It has power.
Absolutely. How about you, Dominic? When someone says to you, as they turn away well, I'm going to say barbaric ignorance, but that's me.
Yeah. Well, if it's not very popular. I think I agree with everything Aria said. I used it, really. You mentioned the Iraq War. I used it 10, 12 years back to express my views on things like the Iraq War. And there was not many people doing it at the time, but I just felt that, you know, through poetry, you can kind of... It's like an alternative news station sometimes. You can kind of get ideas across that you don't see on the mainstream media. I mean, not all poetry is political, obviously, but...
Sure.
I just think it's a really good way. You know, you've got an audience in front of you, and you can really talk to them directly, you know. So that's one of the things that I think is most powerful about poetry. You know, it's direct impact with small audiences. Even if it's a small audience, you can still get that message across. Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing that's kind of interesting about it is that metered poetry has been found to be something that really helps people who are in the throes of dementia and Alzheimer's. It's kind of interesting, but Dorothy Wordsworth, in her later years when she was really struggling with that, the one thing she could do was she could still recite poetry.
Really?
Which is just, I thought that was amazing. Yeah. She remembered every poem that William Wordsworth wrote.
Wow.
And they said it was because of the rhyme meter. It was able to stick in her head.
Well, I address a wide range of issues, like many poets, and I'm going to share a poem I wrote about science, and I want you both to think about a poem that you've written to address some issue. Okay, I once heard, I guess a couple years back, that scientists studying the fossil record have revised some of their thinking, and that for years, the skeletons that they've been referred to as a brontosaurus, it turns out that these really weren't a separate creature called a brontosaurus. They were, in fact, juvenile diplodocuses. And I heard that, and I thought, oh, my God. I started thinking about the ramifications, and I'll tell you what I mean. I wrote this. It's called The Bronto That I Never Saurus. Oh, Bronto... So sorry, Saurus, not once but twice removed from us, not relinquished to museum rust, not languished piano weary neath a veil of dust, must while away the hours you trust, for far away from us you twice. It isn't really very. Not only do you no longer live, not now in that slim aware must give no live, because they said you never did. Not even once did breeding live, deuce dunsing life, not ever child, not ever wife. Reclaimed once, it seemed, from ancient mire. Now, so short in hours retire. Twitch tossed, great long-tailed beast, 500 tons, weaving through our imaginations your lumberings. Come, we thought you dumb. We saw you 10 elephants long. We never thought you hadn't come. 'Twas said, twixt head and tail, a bristly bundle of fibrous fun, you drove two brains instead of one. You cheated death. You cheated grave. You never even really came. A mis-ID'd, they now are knowing, heard from scientific newscasts crowing. Now they know, now seem saying, those in whose minds you once seemed playing. 200 tons, a slowly moving mountain of mistake. You didn't nuzzle the reeds at the lake. You didn't puzzle at volcanic passion. You didn't stumble through the marshy morning while amidst munching grasses muffle yawning. You didn't hug the sunlight strength. You never stretched your tail its length. If you live lusty longer in the mind of those to whom the thought of Bronto comes, small pleasure this then take it comes. You're honored here, if ever future number, ancient fossils done.
Yeah, great, great stuff, yeah.
My little tribute to the Brontosaurus. Aria, how about another one of yours?
Well, I'm trying to think. So you want me to read something that is...
Oh, anything you want. It's okay. I just thought if you had, had written one, if you'd written one to address something, that'd be lovely. But if not, listen, undress something then.
Oh, okay. Because I'm thinking that you want me to read something on science, and I don't think I've ever written anything really for
cup of tea.
Why don't you let Dominic go first? Because I'm going to swim through and see what I can find.
Okay.
Yes, lucky
Dominic,
I've got a third
lay
one.
It on us, buddy.
It's lucky I've got a third
and set
one.
It up.
Yeah, it's called. This one's called "The Old Faith Still Flows Deep in the Heart of Me." The scent of incense in the haze of yielding sacred yesterdays. Bold metaphors of pure gold run through my Catholic veins like blood. I hear the angels' lamentation in the fevered realms of want and night. The abyss sneers at creation, symbols disintegrate into signs. Where is the deep communion in an age of instant access? Where are the beatitudes in a world of swollen excess? I await the coming springtime of a greater light that will seep through the cracks in our dreams, in our elaborate designs.
Very nice. You know, that's such an important feeling, you know, that so much of our fellow humans are running around so fast, priding themselves on this multitasking nonsense, which to me seems to suggest that a far more important truth is you're not giving anything the attention it warrants, and therefore everything blends into a kind of a gray cardboard. No wonder they're feeling like their lives are empty.
Cultural relativism, isn't it? Yeah. I've just been shopping today, and it's just hit me. You know, I'm kind of, whoa, too much going on, yeah.
Yeah, shopping. Boy, that's enough to drown any
parent.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Tell us, Dominic, when you realized that you were a poet, you know, our society values learning so lightly. And clearly when you commit yourself to a life of letters, you know, we answer to a different call.
When did I first realize?
Well, yeah. I was going to ask an even more difficult question.
Right, that's okay. Yeah.
Is your family at peace with your choice to be a man of letters?
That's a good one, yeah. Well, my family, my brother's a pharmacist. It's been a long... I teach. I'm self-employed. I teach privately. Mm-hmm. I teach English and maths. But everything I've done, I've kind of had to do my own way. So when I worked in the education system, I found it very difficult to conform to that because I saw basically what was going wrong. So everything I've done, I've kind of had to do my own way, really. It has been a bit of a burden. Yeah, yeah.
I was once thrown out of a free school for not being Marxist enough.
Yeah.
I
like
thought
that one.
Was
yeah,
kind
it's
of,
good.
You know.
Yeah, I think
Aria,
I'm right here.
Sorry.
So,
go ahead, Aria.
Yeah, sorry. Just when I was talking with Aria over the emails, you know, we both agreed. You know, it's very hard to fit into the society as it is if you're a creative type. Yeah, yeah.
Aria, go ahead.
I was going to read you one that actually I wrote recently that. I think it kind of speaks to how a lot of us feel who are creative. It's called Night Traveler.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer to be undefined, living my life on the meridian line, without distinctions, race, sex, or class. I am a nameless night traveler roaming this earth, an intrepid outsider on a planet that is careless to need, peopled by profiteers of insidious means. I am distinctly not American, though parentage says I am. I'm an alien in thin, papery white skin, a being from the stars, subsisting in this bipedal form, a wrapper that in each mirror I pass is less and less who I am. I could dissolve on the head of a pin, quivering and spinning blue film on diaphanous skin. I am a night traveler who visits home in dreams, where loved ones are not bound in bone, where privilege is not a concept, nor a creeping, far-reaching, odious need that hungers inside and can never be appeased. Within this haunted and hollow sack, pulling and wrenching for the next huffing breath, the name is all, and there is left.
That's great,
very
great
nice.
Stuff.
Yeah. Very nice.
I sent that
I
to
have
a friend of mine recently. Go ahead.
I was going to say, one time when I was fired from a job for not quite fitting in, I conjured up the image of an unemployed Adam. And I the more I thought about it, the more I liked the image. So I wrote this little piece, The Case of the Unemployed Adam. The Enigma players present the intent to disguise from your sardonic surmise and your green winking eyes our pleasant lesson. Impressing finality with reality, our case to displace the initial disgrace at a price which, although quite steep, is seldom by sheep viewed as heavy already. Our connection in this section need be mentioned quite possibly as sheep may yet be viewed as subdued, rude, lewd, hardly and barely crude. This obtuse ruse, like the line of our spoke, cast a rope of hope to the out-daring, despairing am we, locked from the bomb shelter of your heart? Am I, damn I, the fool's gold in the Fort Knox of your dreams? Not to confuse or contort the logic of sane, what do I mean, speaking plain, not to confuse but amuse, our intent scantily sent, nary say die, repent.
Very good, yeah, very good.
Aria, you have another one for us?
Yes. Let's see. I have a lot, so... I was actually going to read, and this, I know Dominic would probably like, because it is for Diana, if you would like me to read it.
Yes.
Please, please.
I actually wrote several poems, one for her, and one specifically for Prince William. But this is the one that I wrote for Diana. It's called Prime Mother. And it's kind of long, so bear with me. Prime Mother.
Okay.
Oh, Prime Mother, are you blind to the dross, godly entail bequeathed to your progeny, the subtle subtext lacing the foaming effervescent sea? This bequest was yours alone to give. It was seen in the faces and hearts, in the flowers that lined and made your final bed. Would you recognize him, the smile situated plainly, under guile and toothy gums, wherein pageantry is gone and the lights dim? Will he still be your sweet, gentle, ingenuous child? O Prime Mother, does he dream of you still? And does that dream wax and press within it, the promise susurrated, the unaffected life, the image you censored? Does he hear you anymore? Does he acknowledge the implications? O Prime Mother, your smile still shines neath the beam in his eyes. Let your open arms adorn him. Let the humble pathos be conceded, no more to be suborned in convenient conventionality. Upset the set, tear the style from your bosom. O Primal Mother, hear our plea. The monarchical choir, where Bobby's nod refrains, a hideous, discordant act of duty. Throw the cockade to the sea, channel a ballooning, polluted pledge to aristocracy. Turn your airbrushed cheek, rosette powdered and keen, to the last, hinting, abiding for that silent kiss. Would we be remiss to stand on, or waiting for her slight form to hail us from beyond? O Prime Mother, your anthem has been acceded to the halls of the aged and the poor, whose little limbs, frail as tinder, lovely embers lit the hillocks, crackling and spinning, dwindling and dying, furious lights descending the hearse's motor, now diminishing the flame she lit as none before.
Lovely. Really lovely. You have such a nice,
and it,
delicate touch with your words.
Oh, well, thank you.
Very well done. Very well done. Good sir.
Yes.
I imagine in your repertoire there is a tribute of some kind to some noble human.
I'm trying to think of a tribute to somebody. I think I did one about Van Gogh, but I haven't got it with me.
There you go. Oh, it's not handy. Okay.
Not handy, no. Sorry.
Do you have the
Dominic,
do you have the Pinochet one?
I haven't got it, no. Sorry. Yeah. I just bought it.
Well, Dominic,
I actually have it on my desktop, but I don't want to read it. It's yours.
It was against Pinochet. It wasn't pro-Pinochet.
Yes, it was against.
Yeah.
But it's still a lovely poem.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you.
Well, the CIA would be very happy with you, Dominic, on that one.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I've read all the declassified information. Yeah. I'd just like to say that about Fidel Castro. I said,
sure.
I think the Cuban Revolution would be written in the stars. And when Donald Trump,
uh-huh.
is consigned to the dustbin of history. So I don't know how that'll go with your listeners. I hope it's progressive, yeah?
Yeah. There's no friend of Trump here. In fact, I was actually hoping to get through the whole show without mentioning his name, but that's all right. You as a poet, poets have, you know, we have our license renewed all the time, so we can pretty much say anything.
Yeah.
Well,
great,
you know, in our household, I do not call him Trump.
Dumpy.
Well, Dominic, I want you to think. Go ahead.
No, his real last name
was
Drunk.
Right. Well, I tend to use the German spelling myself, D-R-U-M-F-P-T. Dominic, why don't you look through your oeuvre and pick something that would be just charming, one of your favorite pieces. And while you're doing that, and I want to ask you the same thing, Aria, I'm going to read one more of mine. And this is a little piece called Strategic Defense Initiative. The warmongers, feeling that without more war, they really just weren't achieving their goals. They went off planet and they built killer satellites. And the Reagan version of this was called SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative. And so I wrote this little poem, sort of an anti-tribute to the idea of killer satellites. It's called SDI. SDI, an orbital poem for the technologically advanced. Can your biorhythms cancel REM sleep? Do your cholesterol metabolism content be counting sheep? Do your misdirected melanomas marvel at the leak? Would you mind if I wrote offline on video varnished sleep? Would your documented study object, you recollect, without reflection, review detection, rescuing the site? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? Batteries of flattery flaunt, the heat printer saunters to taunt, whispering casually, printing passionately, warming his ribbon cables over wrapped royal solar collectors, cables rainbowed in declination, spiral data decollage detection. Does the paper's edge curl just right, sticky edges curving, breaking right? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? Would you wise to wander? Could you kind and candor keep the feeling fonder? Does the digit flounder, keeping parallel data aligned? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? Communications miracles help you remember those zip codes, while giant commercial conglomerates rank the urban air at nodes. Do your cancer studies relate to urban blight, holding precious candles higher, nearer to its light? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? Watching gentle airliners plunge in turbulent wind shear while underrated radar stains to ping. Who was that? Where? Demobilizing scout ships on radar action screens. How does the battery oblige to surge the surging electric spike? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? Stellar lasers mount the rings of accelerator paths. Mega computers spend the day running Uncle Sam's bank drafts. Super calculators on rapid oxidators give the raider something warm. Has the calm bestowed this warm? Hear the walking catfish heading for the door. Don't let them out there wander trailing colors regimental soar. Hydrogen alert bore right here in micro-activated mirth. Has the attorney contrived to rewrite judicial plight? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? Pleistocene press fossils hang in scientific halls with antiquated docels contemplating stalls. Soviets that fly through space have not achieved transcendental face with solar panel funneled grace. Has the salary blown by to scare the electric lamprey sight? Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? For those at home, you bet. Still monitor, don't fret. But that don't mean that idiots obscene and some accumulating calf suspends the graph while addle painting pass rebuke the test. Satellites casting spears of light. Would your quoted survey walk the robot dog tonight? So, there we have that. Killer satellites. But Aria, take us back to the pastoral scene. Take us back to a calmer and gentler time. at least among the literate, huh?
Well, I have one that's actually on the Peterloo Massacre.
Well, go ahead.
Let's see. Let me get back to it because I just went past it, of course.
Of course.
Tell us
about the massacre.
Or I have also, and this one is actually, if I can find it here, let's see. Okay.
Dominic's, is yours ready?
We have about eight minutes left
for the show. Go ahead, read one while he finishes finding.
Yeah.
I'm going to go over something.
Okay. Yeah, this is called Pieta. You know, about the Michelangelo piece. And Aria helped me edit it. I think I've actually got the original version here, so I'll read that.
Oh, great.
The cold marble is caressed with fiery grace in sculpted textures of figurative skin. She holds the body lost in grief's solemn place. She cradles him as though he was a child still, and calmly surveys his bruised and mortal flesh in a cool ocean of soft folded garments, cradles this broken figure transformed in death, who will inspire art's most blessed moments. One whom she bore in the ragged light of faith, who is the unheralded bloodied fulcrum of creation's sacred fulfillment, some say, not a glittering god of the moon or sun. Her repose dissolves the driving, brutal nails of suffering in this wayward, wanton world, where the howling beast, not the angel, prevails, where the primordial word is never heard. Yet in diurnal time that has redeemed time, the crude particular courts the eternal, and a profusion of new symbols and signs are prepared to enhance the all-too-human.
Wow. Very nice.
Thank you.
I've never heard a statue captured that well in words. Beautifully done.
Thank you. Thanks.
Aria?
Yeah, okay. This one is written actually for Lord Byron. And it's from Percy Bysshe Shelley. It's called Baronessy Bastardized.
Wow.
Bathed in the flowering of my hooded knees, beheld their dance, we circlet wreathed in bastardry. Low voices stir upon the pane, in hushes they concur and ring us with disdain. Cherubic and supernal, their countenance, lips on glass, breath blown in gratings, presage a torrential, mellifluous campaign. Gauged in the stays of corsets, scripture, and Christ profane. The faithful stood within, tubular bells, hymnals, and confessionals, humming hateful spells learnt in pews and citadels, whilst in their children's hands they press tiny stones upon their breasts, and lips hurl curses trumpeted from Gabriel's horn, and the lance of Michael unsheathed echoing scorn. Scream strident thrusts through the panel and heralded bust. Crown of Christendom avenged and torn, stealing the breath of the unborn.
Very nice.
Yeah, great.
Well, my friends, I have to thank you so much for bringing so much beauty to the show tonight. I literally take off my skull cap to you and wave my cerebellum in glorious celebration. You did marvelous work tonight. Thank you so much for sharing.
Oh, you're
thank
very
you.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to continue this tomorrow from 7 to 9, the East Coast time. And, you know, it's going to be some more fun. So I look forward to hearing even more of your fine work. And, Dominic, I want you to know that this is going to happen again and again. And, Aria, it is such a wonderful pleasure having poets of this quality. Thank you for bringing Dominic to us.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And thank you for your own glorious work. The English language has been very well treated tonight, and I blame you both. You know, when you hear stuff when you hear thoughts clothed in such glorious language, you can't help but have hope for this crazy humanity. This show, by the way, I know you're relatively new to it. This show exists because I wanted to give people who are trying to do good in this world a voice, a place to spread their information, people who are working to make this a better world. And a lot of times that's environmentalists, it's human rights people, it's anti-war activists, it's scientists, and occasionally I have the good fortune to bring artists to the show to share what they do, to share the beauty that they bring to this world. And I want to thank you both on behalf of humanity, if I may be so bold. Thank you for bringing the beauty that you bring to the world around you. And you've been very gracious, and I thank you.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us on, and I look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
Okie dokie. You all have a good night, and this has been Progressive News Network on the Poetry Show, and I thank you. Bye-bye.
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 Now come on, generals, let's move fast. Your big chance is here at last. Now you can go out and get those reds, cause the only good commie is one that's dead. And you know that peace can only be won when the blowing wall of kingdom comes. Sing it! 1, 2, 3. Lottery fight for. Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Louder! Vietnam. And in 5, 6, 7. Open up for the gate. Well, I ain't no time to wonder why. What the hell on the side?
And that wraps it up for tonight, good people. I want to thank you so much for joining us for Progressive News Network. Progressive News Network, a new Mercury Media production, where you'll find the voices of activists, the voices of those working to make this a better world. We believe that as we face challenging times, the human spirit can face and surmount the foolish and the short-sighted. Tune in every Sunday, 7 p.m. Eastern Time, for the live show, or anytime you can. Progressive News Network, found at www.newmercurymedia.com/PNN/. We have a future. Tune in and build it with us. Underwritten by Florida Media Labs, produced by Rick Spivak in cooperation with Canary and a Coal Mine Films. Progressive News Network.